Good evening. So we continue with 2,000 years of Jewish Odyssey, looking tonight at the 10th century. We're sponsored again by Becky Navi Katz, Lili Shmas Yonah, Ben Rabari Leib, and we thank them for the sponsorship. As the 10th century dawned, the two great Babylonian yeshivas, Sur and Pumbedisa, had already relocated to Baghdad, so they were no longer in their cities of origin. And in any event, Sura had been eclipsed by Pumbedisa in both influence and prestige. A few Gaonim reigned in Sura in the beginning of the 10th century, but by the second decade, Reb Shrira Gaon writes in the Igeres, Lo Ishtairuba Hakime. There were no more Talmid HaChamim left in Sura, and they struggled to find a replacement for the Gaon. The yeshiva deteriorated to the extent that its closing altogether was contemplated, just merge whatever remaining Talmidim where they would be sent to Pumbedisa. But then the Reish Galusa, David ben Zakkai, appointed a new Gaon, Mar Rav Yom Tov Kahana, Afalgav the Oreg Hava, even though he was a weaver, meaning his primary profession was in commerce, a weaver, a craft. He wasn't a noted Talmud Chacham, but the Reish Galusa always had an interest in having two Gaonim so he could play one against the other. In a final and fateful decision, which was out of the box, the Reish Galusa appointed in 928 a non-Bavli as the Gaon of Sura, the only such non-Bavli ever to be a Gaon in Bavel altogether, an Egyptian who became one of the great figures in Jewish history, Said al-Fayume, known to us as Reb Sadra Gaon. Reb Sadra was born in 882, some say 892, which means he didn't live a very long life at all. As a child, he left Egypt and went to learn in Israel, and he became renowned as a precocious Talmud Chacham, as a thinker, and a polemicist. In the last decade, it was a book written by Charles Murray, who's a political scientist, called Human Accomplishment. Very interesting book that I read. And there he traces the most influential human beings in history through their subsequent citations by others. I think he cited the year 800 before the Common Era, all the way up to 1950. And the two greatest, most influential Rabbanim, as he saw it, were Reb Sadra Gaon and the Rambam by their subsequent citations. So certainly in the post-biblical era, he is one of our great figures and also one of the most controversial. Sometimes those two go together. So he was known widely as Al-Fayumi, born in Fayum in Egypt, which is the biblical city of Pitom and Ramesses. He mentions that himself. And he was sent to learn in Tveria. By age 20, he wrote his first book called Sefer HaAgron it was a dictionary with rules of Hebrew grammar as well. And then he started traveling. His family lived for a time in Aleppo in Syria, then again back in Egypt, and there he became involved in open disputes with a very strong Karaite community there. The Karaites were centered in the 10th century in both Egypt and Israel. Those were their main bases of operation. In fact, Reb Sadra's writings, both disproving and mocking the contentions of the Karaites, did much to discredit them and to weaken them and to diminish their numbers. And for this reason, he was attacked both verbally and physically. His house was even burned down once in Egypt by them. But Reb Sadra persevered, and we'll see, he had the gift of perseverance. Among his tactics to combat the Karaites was to write a commentary on the Chumash, some of which is still extant. The Taras Chaim Chumash, for example, quotes it in brief. Reb Sadra was often quoted by the Ramban and the Ibn Ezra, and he also wrote the first Arabic translation of the Torah. So in his commentary also you see the interconnection of the Torah Shebichsav, Torah Shebaalpeh. But Reb Sadra first came to prominence in one of the great disputes to roil the Jewish world, the calendar controversy of 922. I discussed this once at a Shal Shudas in our series, Great Controversies in Jewish History. But this was a doozy. The Talmid HaChamim of Eretz Yisrael had long chafed under the rule of the Gaonim in Bavel, and they sought to reclaim, or at least to reassert, the supremacy of the rabbinate in Israel especially in one area in which the Torah gives authority to the Jews of Eretz Yisrael, and that's in fixing the calendar, the Hebrew calendar. So Rav Aaron ben Meir set himself up as the Gaon and Nasi of Eretz Yisrael, at a yeshiva in Tveria, a yeshiva in Ramla as well, and he began asserting the right to proclaim when Rosh Chodesh would fall. This, almost 6 centuries after Hillel II's calendar had been adopted by all Jews. So in 922, year 4682, in our count, Aaron ben Meir claimed that Pesach, that year, coming Pesach, should properly fall on a Sunday, whereas the Gaonim and Bavel ruled, based on the calendar, that Pesach really falls on a Tuesday that week. The technicality involved a provision in the Jewish calendar that Hillel had put in that we can add a day to a month in which the Molad comes in the afternoon by chance. That was today. Today was Rosh Chodesh, but the Molad was this afternoon in Israel. So technically you can add a day to the month in which the Molad comes afternoon, and then add another day in order to prevent one of the things we always try to prevent, like the classical Lo Adu Rosh, that Rosh Hashanah can't fall out on a Sunday, Wednesday, or Friday. So in fact, if you added the day because of when the Molad fell, and then Rosh Hashanah would fall on Sunday, Wednesday, Friday, you'd add a day as well. So based on that, the Gaonim and Bavel ruled that Pesach would fall on a Tuesday. 2 additional days would delay Rosh Hashanah in 922. Aaron ben Meir, who had assumed unilaterally authority over the Luach, did not add those days. So he maintained Pesach would fall on Sunday. The dispute could not be resolved, and in 922, Jews in Israel and Egypt celebrated Pesach on different days than the Jews in Bavel and in the rest of the world. The only time such a thing has ever occurred. It was a major storm, completely threw off the hotel booking schedules for decades to come. Now, from Egypt, Rav Sadragon wrote to Aaron ben Meir, explaining why he thought Aaron was in error, supporting the Gaonim of Bavel, and pleading with him before it happened not to divide the Jewish people like this, all to no avail. So it happened in 922, while some Jews celebrated Pesach, other Jews ate chametz. Rav Sadragon then went public, publishing his findings in another book called Sefer HaMoadim, explaining in detail where Aaron had erred. His genius then became apparent to all, and soon the Jews in Bavel abandoned Aaron and followed Sadra. They didn't abandon Aaron immediately. Apparently, there are many Jews in Bavel, in Eretz Yisrael, at least another year, maybe two, celebrated Pesach on different days following him until he recanted. But Rav Sadragon's reputation grew. This earned him the enmity of Aaron ben Meir and the admiration of the leaders of Bavel. So it was really this international eminence that induced the Reish Galusa, David ben Zakkai, to appoint Rav Sadragon the Gaon of Suro in 927, despite the fact that Sadra had no Babylonian ties. And the Reish Galusa saw him as a very powerful counterweight to the Gaon of Pumbedisa, Mar Kohen Tzedek, with whom he had sparred on occasion. And Rav Sadragon set about immediately restoring the luster of the yeshiva of Sura. The good times would not last very long. Rav Sadra's cup of integrity always ran over. Just 3 years into his tenure, Rav Sadra ruled against the Reish Galusa in a complicated estate matter. Reish Galusa made a decision, and by the custom in Bavel, whatever decision Reish Galusa made required the co-signatures of both Gaonim to be affected, of Pumbedisa and Sura. Mar Kohen Tzedek of Pumbedisa had his own run-ins with the Reish Galusa, dutifully signed, but Rav Sadragon, fairly new to the job, refused. And he held that the Reish Galusa had made the wrong decision. When the Reish Galusa's son, Yehuda, visited Rav Sadragon to try to persuade him, I guess to make him an offer he couldn't refuse, Yehuda became abusive to Rabsadragon, and Rabsadragon's aid literally lifted him up and threw him into the street out of Rabsadragon's house. As you can imagine, everything spiraled out of control and fairly quickly. Rabsadragon publicly proclaimed that the Reish Galusa was unfit to serve, and Rabsadragon put the Reish Galusa in Cherem and appointed a new Reish Galusa, David ben Zakkai's brother Yoshio. Only problem was, he had no authority to appoint a new Reish Galusa, but he did it anyway. With that, the Reish Galusa deposed Rabsadragon as Gaon of Sura and appointed a new Gaon of Sura, Rav Yosef. It was a very Leibedik and Freilich time in Baghdad, and this dispute raged for 7 years. Who appoints the Reish Galusa? It's the Caliph. The Caliph ultimately sided with David ben Zakkai, and the purported Reish Galusa's brother Yoshio fled to Khorasan in Persia, where he lived in exile for the rest of his life. But Rabsadragon himself wound up in exile. That time in exile, those 7 years, proved to be among the most productive in his life, although personally very painful. It was then that Rabsadragon wrote his magnum opus, Kitav al-Machtar al-Pi'amanat v'al-Atikadat, in Hebrew, Sefer HaEmunos v'Hadeos, known loosely as the Book of Beliefs and Opinions, but more accurately, more properly translated as the Book of Doctrines and Knowledge. It was the very first systematic philosophy of Torah that not only details what Jews believe, but also accounts for other philosophical trends in the world, shows where the Torah agrees and where the Torah disagrees. Rabsadragon divided this work into 10 mamorim, 10 treatises discussing God and creation and mitzvahs and schar v'onesh, the soul, free will, the afterlife, resurrection, etc. He even has the very first logical proof of the authenticity of Maimed Har Sinai. And he had what's most famous, I think the most famous line in the whole book, written in Arabic, is this one. In fact, people often only know this from the book. He said, "La amtana b'nai Israel, anma e'amma de sharia," that umasenu b'nai Israel eina uma ela b'torasel. What makes the Jewish people a people is the Torah and nothing else. And he used the plural, Torah, meaning Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebalpeh. We are a nation that's defined by nothing else other than the Torah. Whatever else we think unites us and binds us and connects us, it's all well and good. But we're Ummah only because of the Torah. That is the common link of all Jews. Every subsequent Jewish philosophical work must refer on some level to Sefer Munos Vadeos. The Rambam certainly does extensively, both agreeing and disagreeing with some of Rabsadragon's conclusions. And the fact is that most non-Jewish medieval philosophers have to reckon with it as well. But it was the very first of its kind, the Sefer Hemunos Hadeos. And for that alone, he was the greatest Gaon of the whole Tekufas HaGaonim, as well as the leading Jew of the age. He also wrote the very first halachic work in Arabic, by topic, but it was started and some of it was completed, but it was never fully completed. After 7 years, Rabsadragon and the Reish Galusa reconciled, but the Reish Galusa died very soon after that, within months, as did his son, Yehuda, who had almost come to blows with Rabsadragon, leaving behind a young son. Rabsadragon took in Yehuda's young son, raised him as his own, but all too briefly. Rabsadragon himself died just a few years later in 942, either at the age of 50 or at the age of 60. Very interesting oddity. He was succeeded by a number of Gaonim in Sura. Sura closed in the 940s for almost half a century, till the end of the century. But other Gaonim were appointed after that. Eventually, Rabsadragon's own son, Dosa, was appointed a Gaon. Rabsadragon claimed to be a direct descendant of the Tana, Rabbi Chanina Mendoza, so he named one of his sons Dosa. But Dosa was appointed a Gaon of Sura in 1013. That's 71 years after Rabsadragon died. So if you just do the math, it would seem that they were reluctant to appoint another descendant of Reb Sadja as Gaon for quite a while. And Reb Dosa was very elderly. I would imagine he was 90, 91 years old when he became the Gaon of Sura, 71 years after his father died. But he only served a short time, obviously, dying in his mid-90s. There's another major dispute that was resolved in the 10th century, in which Reb Sadja Gaon was peripherally involved. So there's nothing more sacred to us than the text of the Torah, but the question that's always asked, how do we know that the Torah we have is the same as the original? What about the Tanakh? Ask the same question. Over the centuries, there was a number of discrepancies that entered into the copied versions of the Tanakh, such that by the 10th century, two schools had arisen, each with its own Mesorah, that of Ben Naphtali and that of Aaron ben Moshe ben Asher, both of them centered in Tveria. Aaron ben Moshe ben Asher, famously known as Ben Asher, died around 960. Reb Sadja had known him when he studied in Tveria as a young man. Rumors persist, you see this amongst the scholars, so to speak, that Ben Asher was a Karaite, which makes sense from one perspective. They would be the ones who'd be most exacting on the text, but why accuse him of that without compelling evidence, of which there's none? There's a record, a letter that Reb Sadja wrote denouncing a Ben Asher for being a Karaite. So the assumption is it's talking about the same person, but we don't really know. There are about 875 differences between the two texts in all of Tanakh. That's the text of Ben Naphtali and the text of Ben Asher, but you shouldn't get too excited. It's not as if one text said Lo Signov and the other said Signov. That type of difference we don't find. Could be that they're publishing that text today, I don't know. But that text we don't find. Almost all the difference, and by that I mean well over 800 of them, relate to accents and vowels, a shva versus a chatav kata, whether a dogesh is needed in a word, where the paragraph endings in the Torah would be or should be. You get in the lead, you see in the Torah that the Torah is divided into paragraphs, psuchos and sumos, divided between having nine letter length blank spaces at the end of the paragraph or 18 or somewhere along those lines. They had those types of differences. Less than a handful relates to spelling, and even those don't change the word at all. Like, for example, even now you see there are three or four areas in the Torah where there's a machlokas, whether it should be an aleph or a hey at the end. Like kafis sachra, you find a sefer devarim. We have it with an aleph, some have it with a hey. Ben Asher also marked the Tanakh with vowel signs. Now we hold, we'll see in a moment, the Rambam cites the halacha, Ben Asher's Torah in terms of psuchos and stumos, but there are cases where the Torah still uses a Ben Naphtali wording. Now tradition has it that Ben Asher produced, that is to say he edited and vowelized what became known later as the Keter Aram Tzova, the Aleppo Codex, which was an entire Tanakh in which he added the vowels, and that became the standard against which the Rambam and other Rishonim check their text, and that's really the standard of reference work for Tanakh until today. The Aleppo Codex being the most authoritative rendition of the Mesorah, although we don't have all of it extant today, most of it still is. The Aleppo Codex had its own fascinating journey. It was given to the Jews of Yerushalayim in the 11th century. It was seized by the Crusaders and ransomed by the Jews of Ashkelon. It found its way to Egypt, and that's where the Rambam saw it and used it. And then for centuries after that, in Aleppo, in Syria, until it was smuggled out of Syria in large part to Eretz Yisrael in the 1950s, where it resides today. So Rambam, in Hilchos Sefer Torah, Perek Ches Halacha Dalet, cites verbatim his version of the paragraphs of the Torah, but he says by way of introduction to that, that he's seen many great mistakes in Sifrei Torah regarding this area. V'chein balei ha-mesorah she-kosim mechabrin lo-diyah psuchos v'stumos nechlokim b'dvarim elu b'machlokes ha-sorim she-somchen aleihem. And all the balei mesorah who write very painstakingly the Sifrei Torah, even they can't agree on where the paragraph endings are and how much space to leave between the paragraphs. So therefore he'll write now, in this, right here in the Yad, he'll write all the parshas of the Torah, Psucha, the Sumos and Psuchos, the Tzuras HaShiros. He writes also there how the Shiras HaYom should be written, how Shiras HaZinu should be written. Kedei L'Sakein Aleim Kol HaSfar L'Gia may have. Everyone will know to use this and correct the Sifrei Torah based on this. The book on which we relied in these matters, who has sefer hayadua b'mitzrayim, shul kolel arba v'esem svarim shahayav v'rishonim kama shanam agim min asvarim. This is the well-known sefer we have now in Egypt. He's referring to what would later be called the Aleppo Codex, that has all 24 books of Tanakh that came from Yerushalayim a number of years ago. The olav hayu hakol somchen v'fisha igiyo ben osher v'dikdek bo shonim harbeh v'igiyo shonim pomim rabos k'moshe tiku. This was the one that was corrected by Ben Osher, who spent many years with great exactitude focusing on what the precise wording should be, and the pronunciation of the words, and the vowels of the word. And in fact, our Sifrei Torah, based on this Rambam, the way we write, in terms of the paragraphs, and the Rambam himself, based on the Aleppo Codex put together by Ben Osher. Now, Ben Osher was also responsible for that bane of many a yeshiva student, the development of the rules of dikduk. The rules of Hebrew grammar came into its own in the 10th century as well. So he wrote the very first book called Sefer Dikdukei Hatamim. Rav Sajja had also written such a book, and one disciple of Rav Sajja Gaon took it to the next level, a polemical level. Another controversial figure, a contrarian, a real character, and that was Donash ibn Lavrat. Donash ibn Lavrat was born either in Morocco, maybe in the area of Baghdad as well, went to study from Sajja Gaon at a very young age, although even at a young age, he frequently disagreed with Rav Sajja. He even wrote a treatise challenging Rav Sajja Gaon's grammar conclusions. Donash ibn Labrat became a duk-duk pioneer, as well as a paitan responsible for the oldest zemer that we have, that we sing on Shabbos. Which one? Dror Yikro. So his name is in it. Dror Yikro Levenu Vaz. V'yin Zerchem, Dalet Vav, Nim Shemchem, Shavu V'nuch V'yam Shabbos. He always put his name, his acronym, in his poems. He also composed the introduction to the Birkas HaZimun for Sheva Brachos. Same basic thing. The Vay Haser Vagam Charon, Dalad Ve'oz Zilei Mashiaron Uvov, Nechein Amar Leitzedek, Lenun, Shei Birkas B'nei Yishur, B'nei Aron. So also Donosh. So he was responsible for a number of these things. Also, most controversially, he introduced Arabic meter into Hebrew poetry, which greatly offended many of the religious personalities of the time. And he also wrote secular poetry as well, and he didn't mind who he offended. His main antagonist was a contemporary of his who lived his whole life in Spain. Donash moved to Spain after Rav Sajja Gaon died. This antagonist was known as Menachem ben Saruk. Menachem wrote what he called the Machberes, which was a comprehensive Hebrew dictionary that became the standard for centuries. It's quoted very often by Rashi as well. Rashi, both in the Talmud and in his Perish and Tanakh, will either say Menachem wrote, or it says in the Machberes. When Donash wrote a criticism of the Machberes, so the battle was joined. Donash criticized Menachem for, among other things, not acknowledging that Hebrew words have three-letter roots. There was a time when people actually fought over such things, and quite vehemently. And he also accused Menachem of betraying Karaite sympathies in his explanations of words connecting with Torah. By the way, it could be that our Hilda Dikduk puts them on a higher level than we are, so we shouldn't laugh that much. Now, their machlokas outlived them, but it was revived 200 years later by Rabbeinu Tam, and Rabbi Yosef Kimchi was Radak's father, who found themselves also on opposite sides. In the interim, another great Spanish grammarian, Rabbi Yehuda Ibn Chayug, lived in the century as well, the 10th, defended his teacher Menachem, but it was Ibn Chayug who proved conclusively that Hebrew words derive from three-letter roots. And that's the standard that we were all raised with, that we learned in Yeshivas Katanos when we were young, even though theories are still out there that really you can break down Hebrew words into two-letter roots. Among the people who maintained that was Rav Hirsch, Amtsar Perel Hirsch. But the standard is that we look at Hebrew and try to ascertain the three-letter roots. That came from Ibn Chayug, and to a more limited extent, Donish Ibn Labrat. Now, all of these individuals were patrons of another great and historic figure, the leader of Spanish Jewry in the 10th century, and that's Chizdai Ibn Shaprut, who lived from 915 to 990. Chizdai was a real Renaissance man, a little anachronistic, but he was. He was a physician first to the Caliph Abd al-Rahman III, and a linguist. He got involved in the wars of Donash and Menachem. But then he was impressed into service by the Caliph, became a diplomat, became a de facto minister of foreign affairs for the rulers. He was a paitan. He was the benefactor and patron of the yeshivas in Bavel. They honored him with the title Reish Kala. It was his letter to the king of the Khazars that's still extant today, from whom we know the history of the Jews of the Khazars. And both, interestingly enough, the rivals Menachem and Donash worked for him. So it must have been a very lively office too. He established the Torah community of Cordoba on firm footing. Or better said, he was the catalyst in ensuring that a Torah center would be built in Cordoba. How that happened involves one of the great legendary tales of Jewish life, the story of the four hostages. In the year approximately 960, four Talmidei Chachamim from different yeshivos in the eastern part of the Jewish world set sail from Bari, Italy. Bari is a seaport in the southeastern part of Italy. They went, as we know today, as Meshulachim, to raise money for their yeshivas. At sea, pirates seized their ship. Piracy was very common in the ancient world at that time. It's had its own revival in our day as well. Pirates seized the ship, took the four captive, and when they found that they were Jewish, although they didn't know they were great Rabbonim, Rosh Yeshiva, they knew they were Jews, they offered them for ransom to various Jewish communities along their route. Jews were good in that time, and they ransomed these Rabbonim. Some today would just leave the Rabbonim in captivity. In time, all four were ransomed. Rav Hushiel by the Jews of Kairouan. Kairouan's in North Africa, in what is today Tunisia. He, together with his famous son, Rabbeinu Hananel, was on the Daf in the Gemara, turned that city, Kairouan, into a Torah center. Rav Shmaria was ransomed by the Jews of Cairo, Egypt. It was one whose identity is not universally known. Some say it was Rav Nassan HaBavli, who was taken to France. And the most prominent of them was Rav Moshe ben Chanoch and his son Chanoch. They were ransomed as well. The sad story is that his wife, Rav Moshe's wife, traveled with him, and she was solicited by the pirate, the Arab pirate, Ibn Rumahis. And rather than succumb to his advances, she asked her husband, Rav Moshe ben Chanoch, a question. Is there Tchias HaMesim, is there resurrection for a person who drowns? And he said, yes. With that, she jumped into the sea and drowned herself rather than be raped by the pirate. Rav Moshe was ransomed by the Jews of Cordoba, Italy, Cordoba, Spain, but ransomed anonymously. Soon after, he found himself sitting in the shir of the Dayan of Cordoba, Rav Nosson, who was learning Maseches Yoma. Rav Nosson could not explain something in the Gemara Yoma, a question that was asked. Rav Moshe ben Chanoch explained that, and then he answered all the other questions that had accumulated over the months. In an instant, Rav Nosson resigned as Dayan of Cordoba and appointed on the spot Rav Moshe ben Chanoch as the new Dayan of Cordoba. Then the pirate realized that he had a greater catch than he thought he had, so he petitioned, what a world, he petitioned the caliph that the Jews should pay a greater ransom now, even though the man was already free, because he had underestimated his value. Chizdai ibn Shaprut intervened and told the caliph that it's better for Spanish Jews and for Cordoba if an indigenous Torah leadership is developed. It's almost an inversion of the dual loyalty argument. He said rather than have the Jews of Cordoba have to turn to Jews in North Africa or Babylonia or elsewhere in Europe for Torah guidance, we should have our own leadership here. And the caliph agreed, and he sent the pirate packing, and Rav Moshe ben Chanoch established the famous yeshiva in Cordoba, which soon rivaled and surpassed the yeshivos in Bavel. And he was succeeded by that son. He traveled with Rav Chanoch as a rav of Cordoba. In just a few decades, Cordoba ascended to be a major Jewish city, and in fact, with this begins what's called the golden age of Spanish Jewry. As Spain's star rose, Bavel's declined, and it was not a coincidence. On one level, the yeshivas in Bavel were victims of their own success, so they had attracted students from across the world and educated them very well, and those students then returned to their home countries, and they became rabbanim there with their own yeshivas and their own followers, and of course, their own yeshivas required their own funding. They had to fund the local yeshiva, they had less money for the yeshivas in Bavel, and that was a problem for the yeshivas in Bavel. They lost students, and they lost money. Bavel also then, in the late 10th century, became more dangerous, especially when the Umayyads reestablished their rule in Spain, while Bavel was being ruled by Turkish generals that had seized power or were the real force behind the caliphs. With the two yeshivas in an urban area in Baghdad, rather than in the boondocks where yeshivas generally thrive, and traveled to Bavel not secure, and to the two Islamic empires at loggerheads, both the funding and the student power of these yeshivas dried up. Sura was in decline before Ibsaji Gaon became the Gaon. Certainly after his death, it never recovered its stature, but now even Pumbedisa was in its last days of glory. But in fact, glory it still was. In 968, the great Rav Shrira became Gaon of Pumbedisa. He was the only one, I should say, in this century, you had a dynasty from the same family of Gaonim in Pumbedisa. Rav Shrira, his father, his grandfather, it could be his great-grandfather as well. All other times, the Gaonim were just chosen at random. But here, they were probably the greatest of the generation as well. He became Gaon, and together with his son and successor, Rav Haigaon, sought to restore the splendor of Pumbedisa by doing a number of things, writing to Jewish communities across the world, much the way in our day people tried to revive the European yeshivas in both America and Israel. Rav Shrira revived the Yarchei Kala before Pesach and Tishrei. He solicited questions and answered questions from across the Jewish world. He wrote a commentary on the Tanakh. And most importantly, in response to a question about the Mesorah, Rav Shrira Gaon wrote the Igeres Rav Shrira Gaon, his epistle, his letter, from which I've quoted extensively in the last few lectures. The question came from Rav Yaakov ben Nissim of Kairouan, who wanted to know, Question that people ask all the time, how did the Torah Sheba'al Peh develop, and what is exactly its authority? Reb Shrier's answer in the form of this epistle that was written in 987 is, of course, invaluable, and he traces the whole history, answering the questions, what exactly did the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah do? Who were the Tanaim? What do they contribute? How was the Mishnah written? Who were the Amoraim? How was the Talmud composed? And how was it divided? And with that, Reb Shira appended an entire history of the Tekufas HaGaonim, literally, Gaon to Gaon, with brief statements of historical importance of events that befell the Jews of Bavel, whether it was the Muslim invasion, whether it was the various persecutions that took place, very often written in an obscure, enigmatic way so as not to rile up the Muslim authorities, but enough that later scholars could, or people at the time certainly knew, but even later scholars could trace back what exactly he is referring to. So Reb Shurgon's answer in this Igeres is the leading source that deals with all these questions. He lived a long life, lived to be 100, but he died mysteriously. Some say he was executed by the caliph for unknown reasons. Others say that he and his son Rav Hai were both arrested, but they were ransomed by the Jews. In any event, Rav Shira Gon served as Gon for 38 years until the year 1006, and his son Rav Hai for another 32 years, between the two of them 70. The last 70 years of the Tekufas HaGaonim. I know you're keeping score out there. Rav Hai Gon actually served as Gon for 40 years, the last 8 years in conjunction with his father. Only time that happened, his father retired due to old age. Rav Hai replaced him in his lifetime, but nonetheless, together, they ended the Tekufas HaGaonim with a 70-year rule in Pumbedisa. From the perspective of the national security of the Jewish people, the century was relatively benign, even serene. The Jews of Western Europe, it's all relative of course, the Jews of Western Europe began to develop and prosper. There's a record of questions sent from Mainz, the Jews of Mainz, Germany, to the yeshiva in Ramlah that was headed by Rav Avram, who was the son of Aaron ben Meir of calendar fame. There was a substantial community in Eretz Yisrael. I mentioned before, many of them were Karaites, but there was also a Torah community that had yeshivas in Ramlah, Tveria, and other cities as well. The community in Israel, though, did suffer again when the Fatimid dynasty invaded in 970. And whenever there's war and turmoil, even if it's between Arabs, Jews are affected by it. In the middle of the 10th century, the earliest part of the Tekufas HaRishonim, it was not really called that yet, a French Rav, Rabbi Yehuda Leontaine, known even in our literature, Sir Leon, and Rav Colonimus, of that family I mentioned last week, of Lucca, Italy, established the yeshiva in Mainz, Germany, in the Rhineland. Rabbi Yehuda Leontaine became the Rebbe of Rabbeinu Gershom, or Hagola, who was born in 960, but was mostly active in the 11th century, and we'll get to that historic figure next week. Rev Meshulam Ben Kolonimus also lived here in Mainz. He was a famous author of the Piyut Amitz Koach that we recite in Musaf on Yom HaKippurim that describes the entire Avodah, that long text during which we bow four times. That was his work. In Mainz, in this century, we also encounter Rabbi Amnon of Unasana Tokef fame. Pressured by the Bishop of Mainz to convert, Rabbi Amnon declined until at one point he asked for 3 days to consider it, saying this just to deflect the pressure. After 3 days, he didn't appear before the Bishop. The Bishop brought him to his quarters forcibly, and Rav Amnon asked that his tongue be cut out, the tongue that uttered, even insincerely, words of doubt. Instead, the bishop cut off his legs and cut off his arms for good measure, as the story written in the Oris HaRuah a few centuries later records. When Yom HaKippurim came, they brought Amnon with his limbs in a bed, look at those things, in a stretcher, and he asked, when they came to Kedusha, for a few moments to Mekadesh Hashem, and there he recited the text of Unasana Tokev that we recite until today. As the story goes, a few nights later he appeared in a dream to Rav Kalonimus, who's Rav Meshulam's father, by coincidence, he's also the composer of another piyut we say on the Yom Narom, Malchuso Vikala Munas Abbekala Daso, St. Shachris, in the Brachos before Kriyat Shema, taught it to Rav Kalonimus in a dream, and Rav Kalonimus transcribed it, and that became part of our davening. It's universal, right? Wrong. The Sfardim don't say it, because it was European. It never made its way to Syria or other Sephardic communities as well. So those who daven, as people sometimes in Eretz Yisrael, in a Eidot HaMizrach shul, have that unusual experience of davening Musaf on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippurim and not encountering the Nesana Tokev, which is such a focal point of Ashkenazim. Another student of Rabbi Yehuda Leontain was Rav Shimon ben Yitzchak, who was the Rav in Mainz, later with Rabbeinu Gershom as well. He was the author of another piyut, Melech Amon, we recite on the second day of Rosh Hashanah. He's the protagonist in a very famous legend. It's known, in fact verified, that Rav Shimon's son, Elchanan, was kidnapped as a child, got kidnapped by his non-Jewish maid, and sent to a monastery, baptized and raised as a Christian, which unfortunately was not an uncommon fate for Jewish children in those days. But the legend is that Elchanan grew up, he's a great Talmud Chacham, he grew up and became the Pope. Jew made good. Years later, his father, as the Rav of Mainz, needed an audience with the Pope, gained an audience with this person, not knowing his son's fate at all, and he entreated the Pope on behalf of the Jewish people. As part of their get-to-know-each-other period, they played a game of chess. And Rav Shimon Yitzchak had never been defeated in a game of chess, and the Pope defeated him. And Rav Shimon recognized the moves of the Pope as chess moves that he had taught his two sons, one who was still with him and one who had disappeared. And it's then that he realized, but they both realized, as the story goes, that they were father and son. They reconciled, depending on which part of the legend, which legend of the legend you accept. He either resigned as Pope and returned with his father to Mainz, or he simply treated the Jews with great kindness, or maybe even both. Now, that he was kidnapped, this Elchanan, and baptized is a fact. The Pope aspect of it is more legend, but it's a typical Jewish legend. I think one that has at its heart the mystery of the survival of Klal Yisrael, always seen as the Yad Hashem operating through covert and concealed sources. So in that sense, at least, it's very much in line with the genre of how Jews look at history. Undoubtedly, the faith of Rabbi Amnon of Mainz was much more common than the legend of this Pope, but that itself engendered these legends to explain this most perplexing puzzle, and that is Jewish survival, which in fact perplexes us somewhat until today as well. Well, just to summarize, the 10th century saw the rise, the life of the renowned Rav Sajagon, who was our first world-class philosopher, translator of the Torah into Arabic, author of the first Arabic halachic work, and of course Sefer Hamunos Vadeos, as well as a world-class polemicist and Jewish leader. We saw the unity of the Jewish people preserved through the resolution of the calendar controversy of the 920s, and through eventually agreement on the standard text of Tanakh, the acceptance of Ben Osher's Parshios in the Torah. This was the century that also began the grammar wars of the Jews, that saw the oldest Zemer that still chanted Dror Yikra, as well as many piyutim that grace our Machzor until today, and the first authoritative and comprehensive account of the Masorah from Sinai until Rav Shrira's Igeres. The yeshivos in Bavel declined even further in numbers and prestige, such that they will cease to be a factor in Jewish life in by the middle of the 11th century, as the era of the Gaonim comes to an end, and the Tkufas HaRishonim, the era of the Rishonim, begins, an era aided providentially by the dispersion of the four hostages to different Jewish communities across Europe and North Africa, fostering thereby the creation of Torah centers in Spain and France and Germany, so that in the 11th century we'll see great individuals, Rabbeinu Gershom and the Rif and Rashi and Reb Shmuel Hanagid and others as well, all of whom will leave an indelible mark on Jewish life. I thank you all very much.